With combined sales approaching the 25 million mark, Pearl Jam have assured themselves of rock immortality by producing some of the most compelling music of the 90s. Although the innate mistrust that the band feels towards sections of the press and parts of the music industry still burn brightly within their collective psyche, their music remains as intense and exciting as ever. I'm radio journalist Max Asanovich, and throughout this audio documentary, we shall attempt to examine how the remnants of Mother Love Bone and San Diego vocalist managed to spark the grunge revolution and help give it the impetus to conquer the world. Our story begins in Seattle in the mid-80s with two budding musicians in the shape of bassist Jeff Ament and guitarist Stone Gossard. Although the pair had played in a number of bands, their newest venture, Green River, named after a Creedence Clearwater revival, appeared to offer them their best chance of success. Along with guitarist Steve Turner, drummer Alex Vincent, and Mark Arm on vocals, the band released a 12-inch EP on Homestead called Come On Down. Although Steve Turner jumped ship shortly after its release, with his replacement, Bruce Fairweather, on guitar, the band recorded a well-received EP called Dry as a Bone that came out on Seattle's influential Sub Pop label in June of 1986. If Dry as a Bone was the archetypal Seattle grunge record, then their album Rehab Doll, released in June 1988, merely twisted the knot even tighter. Unfortunately, the band began to disintegrate due to constant infighting, and soon after Alex Vincent quit, lead vocalist Mark Arm followed suit, eventually getting together again with Steve Turner to form Mudhoney. The remnants of Green River then recruited new drummer Gary Gilmore and brought in a local would-be glam idol, Andrew Wood, who had fronted a band called Malfunction. The new five-piece called themselves Mother Love Bone and set their sights firmly on success beyond Seattle. They released the five-track Shine EP on their own label Stardog in 1989, followed a year later by Apple, their debut album that came out on Mercury Records. The album was a clear indication of the talents that lay within the band, but despite healthy early sales and rave reviews, no one was celebrating. Tragically, only a month before the record came out, lead singer Andrew Wood had been found dead at home, having died from a heroin overdose, although he had recently been through detox. Devastated by his death, Mother Love Bone disintegrated soon after, but Andrew Wood was not forgotten. Respected British DJ and promoter J.J. Fowler recalls.
Mother Love Bone first came to basically my attention through a friend of mine who I'd got a tape through the post of the album Apple, and we were both writing a fanzine at the time. It was called Trash Attack. It wasn't very good, but you know, we were just following a lot of bands around trying to get some free entry into gigs and some free drinks and just generally have a good time for nothing, as you do. And we were writing this fanzine, and I said this tape came through, and it wasn't that great quality, but we whacked it on and we listened to it, and you know, at that time we weren't really into what they were doing, but there was a spark there, and there was a track on it called Stardog Champion, which for some unknown reason just hooked us, and it became one of our most played songs. We taped it off that tape onto like a compilation tape of other things that we had, and it just became a song that we just loved to death, and we tried to get hold of the albums, but they weren't available in England at that time. You just could not get hold of it. And then the singer, you know, Andrew Wood, left this planet to a higher plane, and that was it. That was the end of that, and we were a bit disappointed and a bit, you know, kind of like we thought the band would go somewhere. But you know, they were a really, really great act, and then suddenly, obviously, it became apparent later on to the press that you know, the band members had gone on and gone away to form a new band, which was going to be called Pearl Jam.
Wood's former roommate and Soundgarden member Chris Cornell wrote two songs about his friend and asked Gossard and Ament to help him record them. What had started as a vague solo venture rapidly turned into a major album, and Temple of the Dog was released on A&M in 1991. The album teamed Soundgarden drummer Matt Cameron and Gossard's school chum Mike McCready on guitar, with a newcomer in Seattle, Eddie Vedder, on vocals. Temple of the Dog even performed live, as Jeff Ament and Mike McCready recall.
We did one show, and the only whole show that we ever did was kind of in the middle of getting together and practicing, and we just wanted to, rather than, you know, playing these songs in the basement, we wanted to kind of take them to a different environment. So we just went down to this club and played in front of couple hundred people. And that was the extent of it. Other than that, there's been a couple of shows that we played in Seattle where Chris and Matt came and
did like three songs.
And we did a thing at the Rip Party in LA too, where we played two songs. So that's the extent of it. I mean, we really can't take it any more serious than that because it was just a project. And I think at this point we're both really, really busy with our respective bands. So.
Was it like sort of closing a chapter or paying tribute to a friend?
Well, I mean, both of those things, and also like just getting a chance to play with like people that you respect and people that were your friends that you never really got a chance to jam with. But one of those things that, you know, you always talk about with fellow musicians, you know, let's get together and jam, let's get together and, you know, write a song or whatever. And 9 times out of 10, that stuff doesn't happen, and the fact that we got to do it,
it happened so easily.
And yeah, we both had this, you know, fairly large window of time to do it in, and it actually became a record. That's all, you know, icing on the cake.
Let's hear once again from J.J. Fowler.
The Temple of the Dog album would come out, which was a project put together by the guys from Pearl Jam and a couple of guys from Soundgarden, which was like, if you like, a tribute album in a way to Andrew Wood, who was the singer with Mother Love Bone. And of course the album features Say Hello to Heaven and Reach Down, which are absolutely phenomenal. But of course the highlight is Hunger Strike, which is a song that features dual vocals from Soundgarden's Chris Cornell and Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder, and that again is one of my favourite all-time tunes.
Besides Temple of the Dog, Gossard, Aments and McCready have been working on their own set of demos. They produced 3 instrumentals, committed them to tape and handed it around to industry friends in the hope of finding a suitable singer and lyricist. The drummer of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jack Irons, was sent a copy of the tape and he duly passed it over to San Diego-based singer Eddie Vedder. Vedder had come onto the Southern California rock scene after responding to an advertisement placed in the San Diego Recorder in 1986. The ad was placed by local band Bad Radio, who were in search of a new front man. After hearing Vedder's version of Bruce Springsteen's Atlantic City at the audition, the other members of Bad Radio clearly recognised a good thing when they saw it, and Vedder was quickly snapped up. As well as supplying the lyrics and vocals, Vedder soon became the dominant force within the band. He lent his considerable energies to hustling for gigs, designed the artwork for their demo cassette, and then assailed local radio stations with the tape, as well as printing off handmade publicity flyers. Most aspiring alternative rock acts would eventually find themselves playing at San Diego's Bacchanal Club, and this soon became Vedder's main base. He began to hang out and make favourable impressions on a number of local other musicians. The most notable of these was Jack Irons, the drummer with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and it was he who handed Vedder Stone Gossard's tape, including the 3 untitled instrumentals. In order to be closer to the hub of the Southern California scene, Vedder had moved to Los Angeles after his split with Bad Radio. Working the graveyard shift at a local gas station, he enthusiastically set about improvising lyrics for the 3 instrumentals, that in time would become known as Footsteps, Once, and the wonderful Alive. On receiving Vedder's versions, Gossard, McCready and Ament, who had now been joined by drummer Dave Kruger, wasted no time in inviting the ambitious new vocalist north. And quite literally, as soon as Vedder stepped off the plane, the 5 of them went straight in the studio and spent the next 5 days solidly working their way through 11 new tracks. Remarkably, by only their 6th day together, they felt confident enough to perform their new songs live. And tentatively named Mookie Blaylock, after the New Jersey Nets point guard, they played their first gig together in a Seattle nightclub. Shortly after finishing Chris Cornell's Temple of the Dog album, the band quickly established themselves as prominent members of the Seattle scene, gigging with bands like Alice in Chains every chance they got. With the eyes of the music world slowly starting to fix themselves on the Northwest, the newly named Pearl Jam soon became caught in the glare and was snapped up by Epic Records. Again, the band wasted no time before going into the studio in order to record their first album, which was released in August 1991. Although Pearl Jam had made a huge impression in their native Seattle, with fans lining up around the block to get into their shows, they had not managed to register on the collective consciousness of those outside Washington State. Initially, the sales of their debut album release, 10, were fairly meager, but things soon began to change. In January 1992, the Butch Vig-produced Nevermind by Nirvana quite literally exploded onto the scene, ushering in a new age of alternative chic. Caught up in the ensuing stampede towards Seattle, Ten began to receive the attention that its sublimely crafted songs richly deserved. Shortly thereafter, MTV and the radio stations were playing alive in heavy rotation, and as music fans began to unearth the other gems that lay inside Ten, such as Jeremy and Black, the album started to sell by the bucket load, and as Pearl Jam helped draft the blueprints for grunge, things began to get serious. The remarkable twin guitar playing and the tight melodic songs, coupled with the yearning power of Eddie Vedder's vocals, lend the tracks an anthemic quality that would eventually lend to sales of nearly 10 million albums and help establish Pearl Jam as one of the world's favourite acts. Ever alert, J.J. Fowler picked up on Pearl Jam right from the word go.
Now, you know, reading in the English press, magazines like Kerrang, Melody Maker, and other such publications, they were raving on about you know, the Seattle scene, and this was apparently, you know, the place it was going to be, and everything was going to, you know, explode from this city. And you know, they were doing like little reports on all the bands that were coming out, and one of the reports was on Pearl Jam, and it mentioned that a couple of the guys in the band had been in Mother Love Bone. So of course that kindled my interest in the band, having loved MLB. I thought, well, you know, this is probably going to be really, really good. They had a new singer called Eddie Vedder, who, you know, nobody had really heard of, and the band had apparently got through Jack Irons, who was the then Chili Peppers drummer, had given Stone Gossard's demos to Eddie Vedder, because Jack Irons later went on to join Pearl Jam, which would, you know, makes it even more strange. But you know, Eddie had joined, and like I said, there was great reports, and you know, they'd signed to, you know, Epic Records. And then you know, through the door, through my club work in Liverpool, I got a 12-inch single through, and that was the first thing I'd ever had, and that was for a live. And whoa, here we go! I thought, you know, this was hot. This was definitely good, and whacked that on. But I went along to see the show. I got invited to go along to Manchester in February 1992. To their first ever tour. I was lucky enough to be given some free tickets to that by the record company to go along and check them out, because I'd reacted really well to a live. And I went along to the show, and I was stunned. Stunning is the word. I was absolutely stunned. They were unreal. And you know, they played the whole album, and did a couple of covers, including Rockin' in the Free World by Neil Young, which was a great favorite song of mine anyway. And I thought, this band is the dogs, you know. And and then got the next release, which was Even Flow, and that exploded on the dance floor. I mean, I put the needle to the groove on that, and it went boom. I mean, that was it. Everybody was like, what is this? Who is this? You know, and Pearl Jam just exploded. And then suddenly, you know, the video was on MTV, you know, and you know, radio was playing it too. You know, national radio here in England was playing, you know, that song was really, really getting behind Even Flow. So, you know, it was all over the radio, and in the clubs it was really, really kicking in. And that, you know, their debut album is still today one of the, in my opinion, one of the greatest debut albums ever. And I can put it on right now. I could literally leave this room and put it on now and listen to it from start to finish, crank it loud, and I love it just as much as the first day I ever played it. A great debut album from a brilliant band.
Once again, Jeff Ament and Mike McCready talk us through those early days, and most importantly of all, Eddie's inspiration for the breakthrough single Alive.
I think Eddie was drawing upon, you know, a past experience, but it didn't really have anything to do with, like, you know, the rest of us. I think just the way that he writes lyrics too, I think a lot of them are vague enough and open enough that you can draw your own conclusions from what the story was. And that was the first song that he actually written lyrics to, that before we even got together and played. Mike and Stone and I had recorded an instrumental demo with Matt Cameron from Soundgarden. Stone had a bunch of stuff in the video. And through Jack Irons, who is a friend of ours in LA. He was a drummer for Chili Peppers, and we were talking to him. He got a tape to Eddie, and Eddie sang over three of the instrumental tracks, and the first song was Alive. And that was actually one of the first songs kind of that Stone had wrote out of that whole bunch. So it just made sense that that was kind of like this transitional song. And initially, we didn't even really intend for it to be in the record. It was just going to be in this little three-song sampler thing that we had sent to our club, fan club, the Mother Love Bone fan club, just to kind of tell them that, you know, there was something happening. And we got such a good response from that song that we put it on the record, and then Live, it got a really great response, and it just made sense to make that our first single. So
definitely wasn't planned to be the first single.
It's
at all.
It's an epic song. The song makes me feel the same way that, like,
right now it's like
Tropic of Cancer, the Henry Miller book, where he says, like, you know, I don't have any food, I don't have any money. I don't know, you know, where I'm going to sleep tonight. I'm the happiest man alive.
Yeah.
And it's like, I think at that point, I think that's how he was feeling, I think.
It's like, I would much rather build our base as far as...
Didn't really,
buy our fourth and fifth record slowly,
Or that's my interpretation of it, anyway. I think the songs kind of took on a whole different kind of theory when we went on the road, especially when we were on the road with the Peppers. And we got 30 minutes to basically, you know, show the crowd what we had, and I think the song just became a way more intense thing once we were out, you know, developing them on the road. And I think as maybe as moody and as laid back as some of the songs are on the record, I think maybe some of the intensity didn't come through in the record like we wanted it to, but I think it definitely comes through live. I think even a song like Black is a really intense live. Though it's like a really mellow song, you know, on the record.
Well, I think we've, like he was saying, just from touring, and it's really just we've taken the songs to a new level and made them a lot more exciting. I think so.
I
so
admit,
like, the record is just a period piece when we're that's how we were at that time. And I think we've gone beyond that.
We were actually practicing before Temple of the Dog got together to play. So, in terms of like digging up old stuff, I mean, I'm sure there's always like maybe something that you were working on 2 years ago that kind of pops up into your head and kind of translates into a song. But I think for the most part, we're pretty much going with fresh ideas and new things. And whenever we get a chance to just like jam together, usually. You know, within the first 10 minutes or something, you know, some sort of substance that has an opportunity to develop into, you know, a song or whatever. So we can only do what we do, and the last thing we're going to do is, like, you know, write a song, you know, we're going to try to write a live two or whatever, the, you know, whatever song does well in this record, it'd be totally stupid. I think, you know, if the second record or the third record doesn't sell as well as the first record, well, you know, by our third or fourth record, you know, we're going to have another record that does well. I mean, the timing of songs and music and records and what you're doing and what the people, you know, are into, you don't know how to, there's no way of judging that. We're just going to do what we do. I mean, we're going to be a band, and we're going to grow, and we're going to explore, and we're going to try different things, and hopefully the people that listen to our music will be into that, will want to see us grow, will want to grow with us. Part of the theory, like making the first record, was that we wanted there to be some weird stuff on there. I think like what we did with Oceans, and kind of the beginning and the little thing at the beginning and the little thing at the end, the Master Slave instrumental thing. Some of the stuff like that, I think that kind of maybe gave us a little bit of room. So, the second record's not going to be this huge surprise out of nowhere. There's still going to be rock songs. I mean, we're still going to want to rock out.
Pearl Jam now found themselves very much in demand. An 18-month tour saw the band snake their way around the world, and two further singles were released from 10, the masterful Even Flow, followed by Jeremy, which MTV once again placed on heavy rotation. Jeremy was a striking song about both physical and mental child abuse, but with MTV showing the video so often, Vedder felt that the emotional intensity of the song had been weakened by the saturated coverage being afforded the video. Although they teamed up with MTV to perform an unplugged performance that received rave reviews from the music critics, the video for Jeremy would prove to be the band's last. They even won an award from MTV for that video. Unfortunately, Eddie wasn't too impressed.
Well, we're a group, and I guess it was a video. I don't know how you could say it was the best. It's just a little piece of art. You can't really put art into a competition, you know.
And let's also hear from Lisa Axe, who's musical director at San Bernardino's alternative rock giant KCXX.
The band has not recorded a video since Jeremy back in 1992. Now, that's been almost 5 years now since they've done a video. Obviously, MTV, very powerful, powerful medium to help catapult these bands into superstardom. Pearl Jam, I don't think they want superstardom anymore. I think they just want to be true to their craft. What's so wonderful about Eddie Vedder is he can construct a song that is basically a poem set to music. There doesn't have to be any repeating chorus. He doesn't go by the book. He doesn't have this formulaic approach to music. It's good to listen to, and it makes it interesting for the more, shall we say, sophisticated listener, but it makes it a little more difficult for radio play. What's so great about the band is the fact that they draw on some great rock and roll artists of the past. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was watching a video of Woodstock and watching Jimi Hendrix perform live on stage. And I was watching it, and all of a sudden it occurred to me that half of the riffs that Jimi Hendrix was on stage playing were Pearl Jam riffs. Coincidence? I think not. The fact that Neil Young went on tour with the band and that they've collaborated in so many things, recorded and on stage, just proves to the fact that Pearl Jam is very interested in staying true to the roots of rock and roll and really crafting music as opposed to just churning out hits. Because of their political affiliations as well as their wonderful crafting of music, they've been able to team up with some awesome artists. Neil Young, just one of them. Oh no, I'm going to slaughter this name. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, oh, I hope that's right, is another one that they've teamed up with. Sort of tapping into the spiritual side of music and not just the pop side of it.
As well as performing on the counter-culture jamboree that is Lollapalooza, in late summer 1992, they also appeared on the soundtrack album to the film Singles, Cameron Crowe's affectionate comedy about teen romance set against the Seattle grunge scene. Pearl Jam had actually been involved in the project from the beginning, and as well as making a cameo appearance in the film, taking the parts of Matt Dillon's backing band Citizen Dick, contributed two new songs, Breathe and State of Love and Trust. Let's hear from Jeff Ament again.
The soundtrack is like, I haven't seen the movie yet, but the soundtrack is amazing. There's unreleased stuff by Soundgarden and Alice in Chains and Mudhoney. It's a great Smashing Pumpkins song.
Chris Cornell solo.
Yeah, amazing song. He wrote four songs kind of within the context of the movie, and that song Seasons is a really, really cool song. And the songs that we've gave them, State of Love and Trust and Breath. Breath was an older song that we kind of felt like it was a great song, but we didn't know how fresh it was going to stay if we didn't record it. So we recorded that and gave that to them. And State of Love and Trust was actually a song that was written during the time that they were actually making the movie in Seattle. So it kind of has a little bit to do with, you know, what the movie's about.
In the spring of 1993, the band went back into the studio to lay down tracks for the eagerly awaited follow-up to 10. The pressure that accompanies the dreaded follow-up album to a successful debut has proven to be too daunting a task for a lot of bands. But in October 1993, Pearl Jam astounded the critics with their release of the majestic Verses. The album is undoubtedly an absolute classic, the definitive statement to Pearl Jam's genius, and one of the most important album releases of the decade. The album is a veritable roller coaster of emotions, ranging from the effortless beauty of Daughter to the raging intensity of Rearview Mirror, which in my opinion at least is the finest song of the 90s. Pearl Jam superfan and web author Josh Simon would appear to agree.
One of my friends said I should listen to 10. told him I would, and about 5 minutes later, I was watching TV, and the live video came on. And after it was over, I was just blown away, and that never happens the first time I hear a song. So later that day, ran out, bought 10. I listened to it the whole way through while I was looking at the lyrics, and there just wasn't a bad song on the album. They were all just so amazing, and I couldn't wait for Verses to come out. 10 had hardly left my tape deck. Never even crossed my mind that Verses would disappoint. After listening to it, I thought, damn, this album is just as good as the first. The music had like different sound, but not in a bad way at all. I loved it. Rearview Mirror is definitely my favorite song off it. I guess it's like a lot of Pearl Jam songs to me. Kind of like it came straight from my life, or from my head.
As the music press fell over itself in the stampede to heap praise upon Verses, the fans were busy breaking some records of their own. The album sold an astonishing 350,000 copies on its first day of release, eventually selling a world record 950,000 copies in the first week alone. Let's hear from former NME editor Alan Jones, and then once again from JJ Fowler.
My feeling was that them going in to record a follow-up to such a phenomenally successful debut album might actually be inhibiting, that they would feel a commercial pressure maybe exerted by the record company to come up with basically something that adhered to the format of the first album. And I think they've broken out of that completely. They've been very brave about it, and they haven't felt constrained by commercial considerations. I think there must obviously have been some pressure on them, but I think they've stuck to they've retained their integrity with this second album.
Now the second album, Verses, definitely hit the ground running. I mean, everybody was really, really seemed to be concerned that the follow-up album was going to be very, very difficult for the band because of the success of the debut. And everybody was saying, oh, you know, are they a one album band, you know, is this going to continue? And I mean, if anything, I can't say it was better, because the debut album came out at a time that was just, it was just the time and the place, and then when you were there. But for me, Verses probably is better, because it's more depth, it's more like a roller coaster ride, and it goes from tracks like, you know, Animal, which is a really hard hitting song, and definitely took them over to the barriers of heavy rock from alternative, and of course Rearview Mirror, which was a fantastic song, and became a single. But of course by this time the band had decided not to make any more videos, and you know, and the press hype was seemed to be getting to them, the touring and everything. But Rearview Mirror, that's a great song. I mean, I actually played this weekend just gone. I played it again in the club because I hadn't played it for a while. And why, hey, man, I mean, I was it. You know, as soon as it kicks in, dun-dun-dun-dun, I mean, you just know what it is, and it just rocks along. And it's a great song to play in the club, because, you know, when you've had a few beers and you're with your friends and, you know, you want to hear some great tunes, Rearview Mirror is a really, really great tune. But, you know, so is Animal, so is Go. But for me, what really signaled the brilliance of that album was the standout track for me was Daughter, because Daughter could have been R.E.M. And this took a whole new slant on what Pearl Jam were doing. And it seemed like as though that they were dipping their toe in the water of different things and trying out different styles, just to see what the reaction would be, because they were going to be moving on into new directions, and they were just trying out a few new things and seeing how it would go. And for me, Daughter is the track on the album, and is my personal favorite track off that album, and is probably one of my favorite tracks of all time from the band.
But where do the ideas for those wonderful songs come from? Jeff Ament gives his insights, followed closely by Eddie's idea of an alternative career.
I think you can start ideas, and I think you can write riffs, and you can even arrange a song from your end. But even the way that we write, like, everybody kind of writes their own part, and it's a lot of the songs develop in the rehearsal room. So there's all these ideas, like a ton and ton of ideas on tape and whatever, that haven't been developed and haven't been taken into the rehearsal space. And I think even more than anything, like, I think we're looking forward to just going back and practicing in our little rehearsal place in Seattle, and just kind of getting back into that frame of mind.
Obviously, you've been on tour, you've been all over the world. You must have been absorbing things. There's different cultures, different countries. Do you think that's going to be reflected in the songwriting on your next album?
Yeah, definitely. And I think even even further beyond that, I think next year we're gonna try to tour to some places that maybe will even affect it even further. You know, I think we could probably do whatever we wanted to do. I think, you know, people are finding out that there's not really a lot of limitations as far as where you can play. It's just a matter of like how comfortable you want to be. A lot of times there isn't like a nice hotel and a nice shower like in North Africa or something like that. But I think next year we're going to intersperse like our touring with like more interesting places and not just do like Europe and in the United States. But you know, next year we'll definitely go to Australia and Japan and hopefully some weird places like, you know, Africa and maybe more of the Eastern Bloc countries and that sort of thing. So
let's say I worked in a McDonald's, right? No, but let's just say I will tell you, I'd be the best McDonald's worker they ever saw.
Why is that?
Well, because I'd take pride in my job. No matter what I did, I would just take pride in my job. I really feel, I don't know if it's the same here as in our country, but everyone feels like they can't rise above and that they aren't going to make as much money as their parents and that that there's nothing but negative things in their future. But I feel like I'm a living example that if you work as hard as you can and you have some drive and something that you're devoted to, that with hard work you can achieve that. And so, you know, if I was I wouldn't work at McDonald's because I can't support McDonald's. I think I would be intelligent enough to know that they're doing a fine job at giving everyone diseases and making them overweight by using fancy colors to sell their product, which is meat. But no matter what I worked at, I still would actually play music because I always loved music and it was very important to me. And even if the songs would be heard by myself and my wife and maybe my little kid when he grew up, then I would do that. I mean, then my kid would know who his dad was because he could hear it in these songs. So I still would have played music, but no matter what job I had, I would have done so well that I would have ended up the president of the company. And I hope everyone knows that they can do that.
However, just as the band's fortunes appeared secured and with their fan base growing daily, 1994 saw them collide head-on with an immovable conglomerate that was Ticketmaster. The company had become the US's dominant ticketing agency after their acquisition of Ticketron in 1991. Pearl Jam's first skirmish with Ticketmaster had come in 1992, when the company handled the tickets for a charity concert put on by the band in their native Seattle. The group asked the ticketing agency to donate $1 of their booking fee to the charity, but although the company agreed, they subsequently added an extra dollar to the price of the ticket. This callous act infuriated the band, and in the summer of 1994, as Pearl Jam got ready to embark on a nationwide tour, the simmering resentment that they felt towards Ticketmaster snowballed into a full-blown obsession that nearly tore the band apart. The band attempted to organize their tour without the aid of Ticketmaster, but instead found themselves lurching from one disaster to the next. After cancelled gigs in Idaho and Utah and Vedder's native Seattle, they reached their nadir at a gig in San Francisco, when only 7 songs into the set, Eddie Vedder quit the stage suffering from the ill effects of a poison sandwich and exhaustion. The tour planned to promote the release of their third album, Vitalogy, however, disrupted from the start, was cancelled before it had hardly begun. Although Jeff Ament and Stone Gossard got to put their point across to the US House Subcommittee on Information, Justice, Agriculture and Transportation, the federal antitrust investigation was eventually dropped against Ticketmaster because it was alleged that venue owners and promoters had willingly entered into exclusive contracts with one another. It has proven to be Pearl Jam's most painful and public defeat, but at least the fans were treated to another classic new album.
Third album, Vitalogy, was just so amazing to me. The sound was so different from the first two albums, but didn't lose any of the power that Ten and Versus had. Eddie's lyrics are just so powerful and so true. He just has this way of expressing his feelings like no one else can. I've just never heard any other kind of music, like whatever form that just even came close. I was just left thinking again, if we ever met, we sure would have a lot in common to talk about. Saw Pearl Jam live, I think it was October 7th, 1996, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and it was just the most amazing concert I've ever been to, and they were just so much better than I had ever imagined, and I had imagined quite a few times, and every song was just so clear and crisp, and they were just really on, and if you just let yourself go, you could hear everyone singing along, it seemed like. And I remember Eddie was interacting with the crowd a lot, and they really had the crowd pretty pumped, I'd say, considering like the first third of the stadium was just a giant mosh pit. I remember like right after the second song, Eddie said, pace yourself because you're going to be here for a while. And I think they ended up playing like 28 songs or something like that. And I remember the band was really energetic. Jeff was just jumping all over the stage, just like he does all the time. I remember when they were playing Porch during like really long jam in the middle, Eddie ran all the way over to like the edge of like the stage scaffolding that, you know, holds the lights up, and he just climbed all the way up, all the way to the top. I guess it's probably like 75 feet up, and he went out a little ways over the stage, just started swinging back and forth, and I was just like, oh, he's gonna die. And right after that, he just came right back down, grabbed a mic, and he just told us he wanted to get a better view and that we all look great. There was this hurricane that was supposed to hit like right around when the concert was, but they found out it wasn't going to. The hurricane was called Josephine. This is what Eddie had to say.
It's too many people, and I think it's going to be a great time. Just take your fucking hurricane elsewhere.
Crowd just went nuts right after that, and just the rest of the songs, the whole concert were just unbelievable, just like the first half. And I mean, you could just feel the energy around you. It was incredible. It's definitely best concert I've ever been to.
Our thanks to Josh Simon once again. However, grabbing that elusive ticket is sometimes difficult, as Lisa Rax points out.
I've never had the chance to see Pearl Jam in concert. The last time they toured, they were going through a big brouhaha with one of the United States' most formidable ticket outlets, Ticketmaster. Eddie Vedder and the band was trying to take Ticketmaster to court, saying basically that they held a monopoly on all ticket sales in the United States. So they tried to set up a concert tour which would not involve Ticketmaster. That meant they played venues that did not have exclusive contracts with Ticketmaster, venues like those in the middle of the desert in some small town in Nevada. Unfortunately, I couldn't make it to any of those shows. They ended up playing smaller venues and being able to successfully not use Ticketmaster. In the process, however, I think Pearl Jam also alienated a lot of their fans. I think part of that had to do with less access to the album and less access to seeing the band perform live. Let's face it, when a band is out touring and you get a chance to see them, more than likely you're then going to go and buy the album or buy the album before to get a preview of the show. They were unsuccessful in their bid against Ticketmaster, and I think not only was that a shame for democracy and capitalism, but I also think that it was a shame for the band, because I think there was a bit of a backlash against the band. A lot of the fans felt, why were they bothering getting involved in these political things when basically they were supposed to be a band about music? Now, Eddie Vedder has always said that basically nothing else matters. Music is the main reason that he is involved in the band. And I think that his poetry and the music involved around Pearl Jam, it's undoubtedly true. They're very true to their own vision of what Pearl Jam is supposed to be.
Vitalogy was released in November 1994, and it also saw a new addition to the lineup. The band's original drummer, Dave Kruger, had given way to Dave Abruzzi shortly after the release of 10. But he had subsequently been replaced by longtime pal of the group, Jack Irons. Irons, of course, had been the one to give the demo tape to Eddie Vedder, and it seemed somewhat apt that the former Red Hot Chili Pepper drummer should join the band on a full-time basis. Even through all the internal upheaval and touring crisis, Vitalogy was a fabulous record that cemented Pearl Jam's huge appeal. The hard-hitting Corduroy and the melancholy Better Man, a song that actually started life way back in Eddie Vedder's days of bad radio, were among the standouts on the album. The album was named after a book called Vitalogy, published at the beginning of the century, that had captivated Vedder. Rather than the usual plastic jewel case, the album came in the shape of a book and contained a 36-page collection of lyrics, photos, and notes taken directly from the book itself. The album stormed to number one in the Billboard charts and around the world.
I mean, during the release time of Vitology, you know, a lot of people were writing the band off because of their shying away from the media spotlight, and they weren't doing interviews and they weren't doing videos, and everybody was saying, oh, you know, you can't survive, you know, without doing that. But they were still touring, you know, they were still out there on the road touring it, you know. And then of course they ran into the big publicized thing that happened with Ticketmaster when they decided to set up their own tours, and they didn't want to sell tickets through certain agencies, and that turned into a big massive charade. And you know, of course the media hype on that was incredible, because of course they jumped on them, and because they weren't talking to the press, and because of everything else, you know, that the media seemed, there seemed to be a huge backlash and a huge campaign basically against Pearl Jam. But the music, you know, the vibes, but it was important, and to me the music is all important. And again, you know, Vitology is a fantastic album. I mean, Spin the Black Circle, I mean, put that on in the club, and whammo, you know, 1994, there you go, it takes you back, you know. And you know, and it had some great melodic tunes, like, you know, like Not For You, which Not For You was a great radio tune, but you know, because the band weren't doing other things, radio seemed to be shying away from playing them. I mean, I remember a year later being involved in a station in Liverpool called Crash, which was an alternative, you know, radio station. You know, we were playing dance and Indian alternative and rock music, and you know, this was against, you know, chart oriented stations in the UK, you know, in England specifically. And we were a station that was going more for the cutting edge music, and the amount of people that were phoning up and requesting Pearl Jam, and they were saying, play, you know, play Pearl Jam, because you know they weren't getting played on national radio. They weren't, because they weren't a chart band anymore, and they weren't commercial, and because they weren't doing interviews for radio stations, and they weren't, you know, they weren't touring and over here in England, and you know, there was just seemed to be this backlash that, you know, they weren't on the TV, you know, because MTV didn't have any videos, and they weren't showing their old videos, and they weren't on the radio because, you know, they were just, you know, sending the single, but they weren't doing any interviews, and they weren't, there wasn't the whole circus. But I was getting, you know, loads and loads of requests to play Pearl Jam.
JJ Fowler. Now let's quickly hear from Eddie.
Last night somebody asked me a question. They said, what is your favorite word? And the first thing I thought is, what a stupid fucking question that is. And so I had to come up with something, and actually I figured it out within a matter of a few seconds. I realized that my favorite word was who. I could just stare at that word and feel joy. The band was so important to me, and are still important, and they're out in the States playing Quadrophenia, a show called Quadrophenia. And my wife is in a band called Hovercraft, which there's no vocals, and it's space music, trance music, but it's intense, and they actually opened for The Who, so my wife opened for The Who, so...
Although Jack Irons was clearly a stabling influence on the band, Pearl Jam were reasonably chastened by their defeat at the hands of Ticketmaster, and as their fans became increasingly frustrated at the lack of live shows, the legendary reticence to communicate with the press grew even stronger. Refusing to give interviews and to promote their songs with videos, it came as no surprise to most observers that when the band's fourth album came out in August 1996, the commercial backlash that greeted its release was grimly ironic proof that their endless fights against the establishment had severely hampered their own popularity. The band's new album, No Code, entered the charts at number one, but unlike all their previous efforts, dropped out of sight fairly swiftly. This is, however, no indictment upon the assured quality of the songs on this mature and wonderfully balanced album that veers between tracks like the melodic and doleful opener, Sometimes, to the hard-hitting intensity of Hail Hail. The critics once again applauded the band's efforts, and although by Pearl Jam's mighty standards the sales have been disappointing, those that did buy the album were delighted with their purchase.
No Code took me a little longer to get used to than the other albums had. I think it was because the music was just so drastically different than the others. but the more I listened to it, the more I liked it. That didn't really surprise me. I didn't think that any of the songs on the album sounded like one another. I just think that it was just such a cool album, and the fact that they put it out is just awesome. They just have so much talent, and I don't even think they're capable of putting out a bad album. I guess Pearl Jam's just so huge because, you know, their music's just so easy to relate to and just so powerful. And Eddie's lyrics, you know, if you just read them or you hear them, you're just blown away. I mean, it just seems almost like they're just cut right from your life, at least for me. And I just think it's music you can dance to, music you can cry to, music you can do anything to, and that just makes them great. Also, you know, all the charities and all the benefits that Pearl Jam is involved with and that they do, it's just awesome. You know, they have no obligation whatsoever, and they just do it anyway. And I'm just glad to see that someone who's in a position to do something does something, because it just seems like not many people get done what they could, and I just really respect them for that.
One of the deepest criticisms about Eddie Vedder and the band is that they take themselves a little too seriously. I really don't think that's true. I think that's just the media interpretation. I admire somebody who can take their fame and catapult it into some causes that they're interested in and really affect the way that we perceive causes. I mean, they've performed concerts for abortion rights. They performed at concerts which at the Tibetan Freedom Festival, which was an awesome cause, and they've used their fame to help build awareness on some things that most of us would sweep under the carpet and would never have time to think about in our lives.
The reports coming out now is that, you know, in 1998 on February the 2nd, they're gonna release a new album. It's gonna be titled Yield. And it's, you know, they're returning to their rocking roots, whatever that means, you know, and the first single from the album, which is going to be Given to Flying, is supposed to be very Led Zeppelin orientated. I'm very inspired by that. You know, they premiered some shows in November 1997 when they played with the Rolling Stones, you know, and they were writing new material up to the wire, apparently, while they were recording the new album. And apparently it's got them in the mood for touring again. And some of the songs, Low Light, Wishlist, Pirate, Do the Evolution, Push Me, Pull Me, you know. And there's even an untitled instrumental and hidden track at the end of the album. But it seems to me that the band have found, you know, a new fire, a new reason for getting back out there again. Who knows where that's come from, but we're all, you know, happy that the album's, you know, going to have less emphasis on experimentation and weirdness, and a far more straightforward rocking approach. You know, it's been again co-produced by the band with longtime collaborator Brendan O'Brien. You know, and a lot of it's been done at Stone Gossard Studio in Seattle. You know, and again, you know, at Bad Animal Studio, which of course is, you know, again in Seattle. I hope that they come on tour again. You know, I went to see them in 1997 and they were as good as they've ever been. It's the first time they played England for a long time. I hope they come back in 1998. I hope they come and do some festivals. And, you know, I'm looking forward to the new album, new single. I'm looking forward to playing the single in the clubs. I'm looking forward, you know, to college radio, which I'm involved with. I'm looking forward to playing that on college radio, and all the students are going to flip for it and get back into Pearl Jam again. And it'd be nice if they made a video and everybody got back on the Jam trip again, because they need to. But, you know, in the meantime, you know, go and play the first four albums. Watch the videos that you've got, you know. Get out your programs, look at the pictures, check it out. Pearl Jam are still around. They ain't gone away. They're back. They're bigger than ever. They're better than ever. And I love them. England loves them.
The band have obviously been through some tremendous emotional highs and lows. And no one has taken more criticism along the way than Eddie Vedder. Let's listen to Eddie now, though, put his side across on fame, success, and all its inherent difficulties, and the music business as a whole.
I think it's... If it's everything that you think about when you're a kid, then there is nothing wrong with it. If this is what you dream about, and it turned out to be what you thought it was, then there would be nothing to be unhappy about. But when you get there, it's much different than you ever expected.
Like what?
People start taking things from you. They take things that are important to you, like your freedom and your privacy. And the main thing for me, and I don't mean to just blurt this out, but I've had people like, I don't know, there's a German word, stalking me, wanting to kill me because they think we're in love, or because I write songs about them or something, you know, total strangers. And so you can't walk outside the house, or you can't, this is not something you could have ever dreamed about. And when it happens to you, it's really crazy. It's something that you could only understand if you're in my shoes. And I realize it's hard, and I've had so many great experiences because of music. I'm thrilled. I'm happy to be here, and I think that most of what people think that I'm upset about, I'm not. It's no problem. I'm fine. There's no problem. But there's been a couple of things that have been a little crazy, and I can only ask you to understand. I'm doing my best. I'm thrilled. No, really.
You're more thrilled than you are fucked.
Then I what?
That's a beep word.
The beep word.
The F-U-C-K word.
Oh, I'm more thrilled than fucked.
I mean, you like it more than you don't like it.
Well, it's my anybody in life, you know, has to accept the challenges. And we talked to somebody who earlier, who maybe had a severe handicap, and they're raising to it. So I must be the biggest asshole in the world if my only handicap is being a quote-unquote rock star. I better fucking deal with it, you know. It's a good challenge to have, and I sound ridiculous. I feel ridiculous saying I'm getting better at it. But I would advise, if you're pure about the music, do whatever you can to hang on to the music part of it. Don't get involved in anything else. Be very protective, and I guess try to enjoy yourself.
What do you mean with don't get involved in anything else?
Well, be protective with, you know, things like we talked about before with interviews and videos. Don't become a star, because that's... It's a hollow Easter egg, or a hollow Easter bunny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing inside it. Do what you do for music, and go out there every night and play as hard as you can, and feel good about that. But don't get lost. I don't think we understood that you become a commodity. I don't think we understood that. We thought that was. That was how you got your songs to be heard. And in some ways, maybe it is. And I regret, looking back, there's some things I would change. But I think that a band like Fugazi, who has a lot of these same beliefs, I think they're better because of it. I think we were naive in the beginning. And maybe we had faith in that these things could be good. A video could be an art piece. An interview can be a way of communicating to a large amount of people at once. We lost our faith soon after that, and decided to do whatever we could do to get around that. I feel like I've exposed myself much too much, and I might be doing that very thing right now. But sometimes it's nice to talk to people. You know, you don't do interviews because you don't usually get questions as good as the ones that we've had tonight. I mean, the last question was great, and a few of the other ones were great. So I think the way you should do interviews is actually have real people who listen to your music ask you the questions, and not... people who are working me.
With Pearl Jam now using Ticketmaster's rival, ETM, to distribute their concert tickets, the band have been back on the road in 1997, with a hugely successful tour through Europe. No one knows what 1998 and beyond will hold for the fortunes of Pearl Jam, but no matter what musical avenues the band explore in the future, it will undoubtedly be done with the same compelling intensity, hard work, and total conviction that one of the world's finest and brutally honest bands always bring to their memorable music.
I still don't feel like we're completely known. Maybe it's not that. No matter how known we are, I'll always be overwhelmed. I'm still the same. I'm afraid. I'm still the 14-year-old kid that I always was.